Welcome, everybody. This is the third lecture for the Mises Academy Economic History class on the sovereign debt crisis, although it's really not economic history at this point, it's economic current events. So the official title for tonight's lecture was History of Interventions, and I had planned on coming into this to give you a blow-by-blow and just, you know, go over the major events bring us up to the current position, and then next week, the last week of this short little class, I was going to then, you know, summarize the current situation and say, okay, what's in store in the future. But I think that that's not largely what I'm going to do tonight, as you're going to find out. All right, and so I think part of what I'm trying to do here, I mean, these events are unfolding in real time, if you'll forgive the cliched expression, and as some of you have noticed, if you're on the email distribution list, I've been posting articles that are literally breaking this week that I wanted you to try to read for tonight if you had a chance to look at those, right? So what I'm going to try to do is teach you to fish as opposed to giving you a fish, if you're familiar with that metaphor, in the sense that this stuff is ongoing, and I think I'm going to give more value to you rather than me go through and just parse the readings that I've given you so far. I think what I'm going to do tonight is largely focus on explaining certain terminology and explaining why people are focusing on certain things so that you can understand when you read these news articles and understand what the big picture is, right? So there will be a little bit of the history, but you'll see it's this today's lecture, actually, as I was getting ready to do it, it turned into something that this is not what I had in mind, but I think what I'm going to give you tonight is better than what I had planned on giving you, okay? And it's entirely possible by next week that I'll give you something that does give you the chronology. Part of the problem, just in case you're curious, the Federal Reserve is very good about giving a chronology of the stuff that they did during the financial crisis. You know, so they have explicit timelines, and you can click on stuff, and they're linked to other, you know, like the Fed announcements when the thing was happening. And so I was trying to find something analogous to that for the ECB, and thus far I haven't found it. You'll see tonight I actually did find something since I put the assigned readings up that largely did what I want, and that's what I'm going to focus on a lot for tonight's lecture. But that's part of the problem, is the kind of thing I wanted to give you, I can't get my fingers on it, and so I'm going to have to settle for the data sources and things that I could get. Okay, so I'm just titling this part of the lecture Miscellany, and you'll see why. So I'm going to go through. Now, where I got this from, this is not on the syllabus. You can see the source down here for those of you who have access to the PowerPoints. So I'm on slide A, Assets and Fear, and you can see this source. So this is a great document on my personal blog when I was going to teach this class. I, you know, cast a wide net and say, hey, I'm teaching a class on the sovereign debt crisis. Anybody who can find compilations, things that systematically deal with a lot of this stuff that's in one nice spot, send it along. And so my buddy who works at a hedge fund sent this thing, and from the BIS. This is pretty good. So if you like the charts that I'm including here, I probably got about 10 or so from this particular document that came out in June of this year. There's more of it there, or if you want to go and read what the analysis is that goes along with these charts, this is the hyperlink for you. Okay, but let me just spend a little bit of time. So again, what I'm doing right now is I want to make sure you guys, when you're reading these news articles, or if you're reading bloggers talking about this stuff, that you understand what they're talking about, what these terms mean, because a lot of it, people just start throwing around terminology. And if you don't feel like spending an hour and a half Googling everything, you don't even know what they're talking about. So that's partly what I'm doing right now. I just want to make sure you understand what these terms mean and why they're supposedly relevant. Okay, well, the first one here, you guys know what equity prices are. Just think stock market. Equity, this is obviously very basic for some of you, but some of you, perhaps not. Some of you, I think, are undergrads, and some of you don't know this stuff. So equity versus bonds or debt, right? So equity means that you take ownership in the firm. So like corporate stock is equity, whereas debt is like bond, where you're lending money to the corporation is going into debt, and that's how they do their financing. So, and you as an investor, then you can have assets that are either equity or bond or debt. So that's why they're calling this chart asset prices, because these are the prices of various stocks, and then they're also talking about the prices of bonds over here. Now, so anyway, this first chart's kind of interesting just because you can see the difference in the stock market performances of the United States represented by the S&P 500 versus the Dow Jones European Stock Index versus the Japanese major index. Right, so that's just interesting if you wanted to see that. This corporate bond spread here, what that's talking about, and why I called this slide fear, is what they're trying to show you here is the to somehow quantify how scared the markets are. And so the bond spreads are, so if you can, you know, read this thing, you say number two, what is that? And it says indices of investment grade bonds and basis points. Okay, but the spread, they're saying it's the difference. All right, that's what the term spread means typically in this context. So it's corporate, you know, an index of corporate investment grade bonds minus probably the government's the yield on government debt. So in Europe, it's probably minus, you know, the German banks versus the U.S. Obviously, it's the federal government. So partly, so what you're supposed to get out of this chart is just to see that, oh wow, in the you know, summer and fall of 2008, you see that these spreads get really high. And I'm going to show you on the next slide why that happened. Okay, but then they subsided. And so you can see that the spreads here, they're higher than they were like back in 07, but they're nowhere near where they were here. So this is the sense in which a lot of people say, oh, the financial crisis, you know, the world was in a panic in the fall of 2008, but since the Fed and the ECB took aggressive action, you know, investors calmed down, and thank goodness we got out of that, but you know, still with our heads on our shoulders, that kind of thing. So that's partly what they mean. Here, this equity implied volatility, and you can see it's almost hard to distinguish these because they overlap so much. So what's going on here? Volatility meaning, first of all, the equity meaning in the stock market, and then the volatility meaning, I'm obviously using dumbed-down terminology here, like how much is it likely to go up or down? Like how uncertain are we that there's going to be stability in the stock market? And so I just want to very quickly talk about how do they know that? What does that even mean? Right? Because if you just think about it for a second, that's kind of an odd statement that they can say, looking at the markets, we're going to figure out what the implied volatility of the stock market is. Because it's a forward-looking measure. All right? So you see here, when the crisis really hits, boom, this thing goes through the roof. And then it subsided, oh, and then it jumped up again in late 2009, and it subsided, oh, and then it spiked again. Okay, when you remember these fears over, Japan, right, because it's a blue line. I don't want to make a fool of myself, but is that probably when the tsunami hit? I don't remember off the top of my head when that thing hit, but I'm wondering if that's why that thing is doing that right there. Okay, so I'm trying to just show you how to read this stuff. So now what does it mean? Just spend a minute or two for those of you who have never heard this before, because it is fairly interesting to show the intersection of economic theory and the real world markets. So what they do, they want to get some actual market-based measure of volatility, but again, it's a forward-looking measure. So this spike here, this is not saying, oh my gosh, the stock market fell in the fall of 2008, and so that's why the volatility was really high. That's not actually what it's doing. So it's not looking at historical price changes and then computing some average and reporting it. That's not what this graph is. This implied volatility, if you go and look at the footnote, it's footnote 5, it says the volatility implied by the price of at-the-money call option contracts on stock market indices in percent. All right, so this is not a course in financial engineering, so I'm not going to parse that completely, but just for your own general knowledge, for those of you who don't know this stuff, so what's a call option is a derivative contract, and that gives you the right but not the obligation to purchase some asset at a specified price called a strike price. So if a call option is in the money, it means it's allowing you to buy something at a favorable price. Right? So if you have a call option that lets you buy whatever, IBM stock, I'm just making these numbers up, at $100 a share, and right now IBM's selling for $110, then the call option's in the money. Right? Because you can buy at $100 with this contract, that's what this call option is giving you the right to do, and anyone in the market has to pay $110 if they want to go. That's the current market price. So that thing is worth $10 to you for every share that it entitles you to buy if you exercise it right now. All right, so that's called in the money. A call option is out of the money if the strike price in that contract is above the current market price. So at the money means if you were to go out and buy a call option that's written up such that the prevailing market price on the underlying asset right now is what's written in at the strike price, then that's what it means to say a call option at the money. Okay, so what in the world do call, and so you say, what's the underlying asset? Well, they're not talking about IBM stock, they're talking about stock market indices. So, for example, this red line here for the U.S., this VIX index, you see in parentheses it says S&P 500. So what that's saying is the way they compute this is they're looking at the actual market prices of call options that were giving you the right to buy into an index fund that gives you, you know, small chunks spread out over the entire S&P 500, right? So it's not just buying one particular stock, it's the whole S&P 500. And so that's what they're computing. Now, last part of the puzzle, you say, well, okay, but why are you talking about call options? What does that have to do with volatility? Well, because if you look into the standard models, like the Black-Scholes formula, if you've heard of that, the way you, the arbitrage-free pricing, the way they compute in terms of these models, what is the correct price of a call option? Because if you think about it, that's conceptually kind of an odd thing. I want to sell you this derivative contract. I'm not selling you the shares of stock. What I'm selling you is this thing that gives you the right to buy into the S&P 500, part of the index of it, at a certain price. And right now, the price that we're targeting, it gives you the right to buy it at that price, is the current market price. Right? So right now, this thing is worth nothing. If the S&P 500 just stayed flat, this call option would be completely useless. Right, because it would just give you the right to buy at the current market price. Well, there's no, you know, that doesn't give you any advantage. So then the issue is, how do I know how much to charge you to give you this thing? And then you as the buyer, how much should you be willing to pay for it? So the models they use, it turns out, an important parameter in the solution, assuming that the assumptions of the model are correct, is the volatility of the underlying asset. So just intuitively, if you think about it, so I'm selling you this thing that says, look, over the next year, at any given time, you can exercise this call option, you can buy the S&P 500 at this particular price, the more volatile the S&P 500 is likely to be, the more valuable this contract is, an expectation. Because, yeah, the S&P might crash, but if there's a chance it's going to go way up, it's real valuable too. See, because the call option is not committing you to buy. So if the S&P crashes, you just let the option expire. But if the S&P goes up 20%, well, then you come in and you exercise that thing, and the call option at that moment would be very valuable to you. All right, so that's the logic. So that's why the pricing of call options is dependent on what people think the volatility of the underlying asset is. So that's how they get these things. And so what they're saying is, what this really means is, the price of other things equal, the price of call options on these stock market indices went way up in this period, and then in Japan went way up here, because the people in the market at those points were just very, you know, they had no clue. They're like, the market could go way up in the next 6 months, or it might crash. We have no idea. Whereas in other periods, they're more certain about the window of likely movements. And so that's why call options wouldn't have such a high price. Okay? Probably spent too much time on that, but I wanted to just make sure you guys got that. So that's why those things are considered to be indices of what the market's view of the stock market's volatility going forward is. Okay? Because these are based on real prices. So a lot of this stuff, it's commendable that they're not, it's not like they call up Paul Krugman and say, hey, give us a Keynesian econometric model and tell us what you think. Or it's not like they survey a bunch of economists who write for the Wall Street Journal and work at think tanks and say, what do you think the market's going to do? That these things are market-based measures, people who have real money on the line. So you know, that gives them some more credence than you may have at first wanted to give them. Okay, next slide, U.S. bond yields. Here, I just want to show you, I want to decompose that. In the first slide there, I showed you the chart of the bond spreads, and you saw how they shot up when the crisis really kicked in the fall of 08, and then they subsided. So this is, just to decompose that, you can see what was going on here. So this chart, I did it with the U.S. just because I can more easily graph this stuff and get the information very quickly because I know how to use the FRED website, but you would see a similar thing if you did it in European markets. So you can see back in 2007, the ranking of these things makes sense. The blue line is the yield on three-month treasuries. The red line is the yield on corporate bonds that are rated AAA, and the green line is the yield on corporate bonds that are rated BAA, meaning Moody's says those bonds are more likely to default than the AAA ones. And of course, at least back then, the presumption was the U.S. government is less likely to default than any of these corporations. So it was considered the ultimate safe asset. So those yields line up the way you'd expect. And that's true throughout this history, that the blue line's always on bottom, the red's in the middle, and the green's on top. But you can see how the difference between the two, so if you were charting the spread, that would have blown up in this period here when the crisis really set in, and then it would have subsided a little bit going forward, but it still would have been much greater than it was back here. So you can see when the crisis really hit in those few weeks surrounding the collapse of Lehman, it was both. You had things going at both ends. You had the yields on U.S. debt dropping, and you had the yields on corporate debt rising. So that's why the spread went so high in that period. But then since then, you can see the yields on corporate debt, at least in the United States, AAA and BAA, are actually lower than they were back here. All right, so it's interesting. I'm partly showing you this just to make sure you guys realize that depending on your view of things, you might have thought the corporations were having a really hard time borrowing money, and that's not entirely true, at least if you're looking at the interest rate they have to pay. So really what's driving the bigger spread now between these two things, it's not so much that everybody's, let me put it to you this way. Before seeing this decomposition, you may have thought that all the investors were dumping corporate stock because they were so worried about the real economy and then rushing into treasuries. But as you can see from this, that's not necessarily what's going on. It looks like more what's happening is just in general there was this huge move into treasuries, but it's not that everybody was dumping, it has dumped corporate stock, or sorry, corporate bonds. And that's what, and the yields on them are a lot higher. That's not the way this played out. So, you know, here I'm just speculating, but it's possible that a lot of this is driven by what central banks have been doing, because obviously central banks have been engaging in massive purchases of government debt, not massive purchases of corporate bonds. So, anyway, you can puzzle that out yourself. Okay, price inflationary pressures. Here's a good one, just giving you a summary of the history over the last few years of CPI, commodity prices, and what's called break-even inflation rates. in the U.S. versus Euro, Japan, and the U.K. So for the purposes of this class, this is a nice snapshot to give you a bird's eye view of these things. What's interesting is you can see what's going on in the United Kingdom. They are hardly in the grips of a deflationary trap. Okay, so I mean, partly why I'm showing you this stuff, if you've been reading Paul Krugman, you would think that the whole world is trying to stave off becoming the next Japan, when that's not really what the data seem to suggest, even using the various government's own conventional figures. Okay, another interesting thing, the reason I like this chart, is you can see if you start back in 05, and that's where you, so I'm looking at this middle diagram here on commodity prices, and set the index there, you know, so what they do with these things is they take all their prices, you know, they get the index like the composite, the agricultural, crude oil, and so forth, and then they normalize the prices, you know, they set them equal to 100 back here, and then they just look at how much has the index moved since then. You can see that gold, well, we'll call them precious metals, has outperformed all these other things. Even, you know, it's crushed crude oil, it's even beaten agriculture if you start the thing back in 05. All right, so that's, I'm only mentioning this because when I argue with people on this topic, like just literally today on my blog, I was mentioning how, you know, the Austrians, the people worried about central banks causing price inflation, have an ace in the hole in terms of gold and silver prices. And people were saying, oh, well, you guys, well, how come coffee's up more than gold over the last year? You know, are people hoarding coffee to use as a medium of exchange? Ha, you guys are idiots. Which, you know, even if that were true, that's not going to bother me any, that the fact that a particular commodity is up more than gold over the last 12 months. But the point is, starting in 05, the precious metals are outperforming these other things. Okay, let me just say a little bit about this break-even inflation rate. You hear that a lot. Let me just quickly explain to you what that is. So you go and you look at the footnote 3. It says, the yield on the 10-year nominal government bond less the yield on the 10-year inflation index government bond in percent. So first of all, just you can see it that this notion that, oh my gosh, we're all stuck in a deflationary trap and we're going to beat Japan. Yes, there was a brief period in the fall of 2008, you know, going into November and December, where price inflation did come down to roughly 0% in terms of the expectations. But then in the U.S., the euro area, and the U.K., they all came back up to basically pre-crisis levels. Whereas in Japan, it slumped, then it came back up to zero. So that's one thing. But now, what does this mean, is break-even inflation? Because you hear that referenced a lot if you're reading blogs on these things. In the United States, I'll just talk about that, and it would be analogous for Europe and the UK. In the United States, what they mean is they look at the nominal interest, so it's nominal bonds, just conventional, regular old bonds, issued by the U.S. government for 10 years. So they look and they say, what is the yield on that? All right, I'm just making up numbers. Let's say that that's 3%. Then they say, okay, what's the yield for a bond issued by the U.S. Treasury for the same time period, 10 years, except now we want to look at the type of bond that's inflation protected. So not just a conventional nominal bond where they just promise to give you a certain amount of dollar payments and then return your principal. No, we want to look at these things where are called TIPS, T-I-P-S, which stands for Treasury Inflation Protected Securities. So what the TIPS is, it's still a bond issued by the Treasury, so they auction those things off. Investors give them money right now to get these TIPS, and they have a contractual interest rate, and so they're paying you a certain dollar amount. But the trick is, they regularly update the principal of the bond. So instead of you just buying something that has like a $1,000 face value that gives you whatever 3% annually, instead of that, what you're buying is this thing that's promising to give you a certain percentage, but the amount to which that percentage rate is applied is periodically adjusted by the government based on changes in the CPI. So if CPI goes up 5%, then this bond that you're holding, this TIPS bond, the government changes it so it's as if the amount you originally lent to them went up by 5%. So they keep paying you the same contractual interest rate, but the base to which it's applied is adjusted with CPI inflation. Right? So that's why it's called inflation protected security. So the idea is you're always getting I'm belaboring the point too much because we've got a lot of material. The idea is the contractual interest rate that the market determines on TIPS is considered to be the real rate of interest. That's the real rate of return that investors require in order to lend money to the U.S. government. So it's because the issue is the nominal interest rate. You know, if investors over the next 10 years say, I'm willing to lend money to Uncle Sam at 3%, that alone doesn't tell you what the real interest rate is, because if investors thought on average prices were going to go up 3% a year, then the real interest rate is zero. They're basically just lending money to Uncle Sam to get the same purchasing power back. But if investors thought that prices were going to rise on average 1% a year, then the real rate of return is 2%. Okay, so that's how it works. So that's why if you subtract the two, you're supposed to be able to back out what the market's expected price inflation is over the next 10 years. That's what these graphs are charting. So again, all this stuff, these are forward-looking measures that are derived from not all this stuff, but this one is a forward-looking measure, whereas this thing over here, headline consumer prices, you can see in the footnote, it says year-on-year changes in percent. So this stuff is backward-looking, whereas this one is forward-looking based on market prices. Okay, just some more general knowledge. Interest rates in the U.S., euro area, and Japan. I'm not going to focus on that because that's obvious. You can see here, this is a pretty good chart. A lot of this stuff is some of the same material that I gave to you in week one, I think. But here, it's all in one spot, and it's plotted out as opposed to you having to graph it yourself using the interactive tool that I gave you in week one. All right, so here you can see, these sovereign bond spreads in particular. What is this first chart? You can see that Greece is leading the pack, and the other pigs countries are ranked accordingly. So what are these things measuring? You go and look at the footnotes. This is a 5-year nominal yield over the 5-year nominal German bond yield. Okay, so the idea is like this red thing of Greece. What does this mean? It's saying here, like when it's almost at 1,500, and it's in basis points. So the way you read this is you say, okay, at this particular point, the interest rate on 5-year bonds issued by the Greek government was 15 percentage points higher than a 5-year bond issued by the German government. All right, so that's humongous. In the bond markets, 1,500 basis points or 15 percentage points. So if the German government, the 5-year yield is 2%, that means the Greek government's yield is 17%, meaning obviously investors are a lot more leery of lending their money to the Greek government than the Germans. And this is out of date here. Lately, the yields on Greek debt are over 50%, right, which is just crazy. So, like I said, this stuff is really blowing up before our eyes. Okay, sovereign CDS premia, I already mentioned to you how that works in the first lecture, the credit default swaps. That's like using the price of getting a third party to insure the bond issued by these governments. Using those prices, you can sort of back out and see what the market's expectation of default is. And so that's why these things are informative in that respect. Okay, bank capital ratios and credit spreads. I think I'm just going to move on because there's a lot of material. I mean, a lot of this stuff is self-explanatory. I just want to put it for you here all in one spot. Same thing with real GDP. You guys don't need me to tell you what that is. It's just interesting if you want to look at it and see who's been hit the hardest by these crises in terms of measured output. Again, real estate prices, you guys know what that means. Same thing with the debt. I've given you this information through the interactive tool in the first week, but this was such a neat little chart, having it all right there. I wanted to put it there for you. Like booms in construction and financial sectors, again, a lot of this is self-explanatory. Same thing here with government debt. So you can see Greece, for example, really has shot up, you know, during the crisis. For example, as late as 2007, only 113% of its debt to GDP, 2010 up to 147. But as people are pointing out, and this is a major point of people like Paul Krugman, it's not, this isn't the whole story. Okay, you have to be a little bit more nuanced. So yes, the Greek government started running massive budget deficits and its debt was going up, but, you know, it's, let me put it this way. If I just showed you this chart and said, which of these countries do you think bond investors are attacking, you know, whose interest rates are 50% right now, if you didn't know the history, if you just had this information and you didn't know much about the culture or anything, you might think, you might not know it was Greece, because, for example, Japan, you know, their debt has gone up, and right now you can see their debt to GDP is over 200%, you know, which is much higher than anybody else's. So if you didn't know any better, you might think that interest rates in Japan were the ones that were above 50%, but obviously they're not. They're very low. For various reasons. You can also see Ireland is just, in terms of the increase, just is astounding that they went from basically 29% in 07 to now 120%. And remember, so a lot of that, remember, is because they foolishly gave a blank check to bail out all their banks. And so that's part of what's going on there. And again, also Italy here, just looking at these figures, I mean, yeah, right now in 2011, wow, 129% debt to GDP ratio, that's pretty high. But back in 2002, it was 119%. Okay, so I'm showing you this partly just obviously so you guys know it, but also it is true. Guys like Krugman, you got to be careful with him. It's not enough just to say, oh, yeah, these governments were irresponsible. They have welfare states that ran up big public deficits, and now they're paying the piper. That the story has to be a little bit more nuanced than that. Okay, let's talk a little bit about central bank activism. And this is really, in terms of a theme, let me just scope out where I'm going, and this is going to be part of what I'm going to talk about next week in the last lecture. So this, of course, is my personal take on this, but I think that, you know, the data are consistent with what I'm saying, but this is just so you have an idea just to try to focus this. My concern is that in the big picture, what's happened is we had, you know, in the United States primarily, but also in the rest of the world, you know, you had the tech bubble in the late 90s, that collapsed. The Fed inflates to get us out of that, just as Paul Krugman recommended they should, incidentally. And then, so the tech bubble got replaced by a real estate bubble. And as we saw in the first week, that was a worldwide phenomenon, and we can, Austrian theory can explain that. You know, it wasn't just the Fed, there were other central banks were operating in coordination with it, either because they would have on their own chosen to do that, or because of just the nature of the international financial system at this point, how it's so heavily centered on the dollar that when Greenspan at the time decided to inflate, that kind of put pressure on everyone else to do the same thing. So then we had that, and that a bunch of private banks for various reasons because of implicit backstops. You know, they thought there was such a thing as the Greenspan put because of things like the government implicitly guaranteeing Fannie and Freddie's debt because of stuff like federal regulations that encourage banks to make loans to people who would not otherwise qualify. All that stuff, for whatever reason, and also surely because of their own personal greed and the culture that took over in short-term thinking and faulty models used by the ratings agencies. So for all those various reasons, we can quibble about which factor played how much of a role in this. The private investment banks got into trouble and came to a head in the fall of 2008. And at that point, there was a crisis, and policymakers had to make a decision. Are they going to just let a bunch of these major international investment banks go down? Because that's how bad the situation was at that point. Yes, serious major international companies would have gone under, household names, you know, Lehman Brothers, Goldman Sachs, AIG, would have gone under, because that's how bad the situation was, okay? And that was kind of incredible to people. They couldn't believe things had gotten that bad. So instead of that, we saved the day. The central banks inflated. So now it's getting to the point where it looks like governments are going to go down because a lot of these governments bail these things out. So like in the United States right now, Fannie and Freddie, I don't remember the exact number off the top of my head, but they, of all new mortgages that were originated in the U.S. in the last few years, the federal government through its now, you know, seizure of Fannie and Freddie, it's some unconscionable number. It's something like, again, don't quote me, but I want to say it's like 98% or something like that of all mortgages that have been originated in the U.S. in the last few years are in some way either literally owned directly by the government or are guaranteed by it. And so the taxpayer is on the hook if the housing market collapses again. And, of course, you know, Ireland's government guaranteed all their banks and so forth. All right, so it's true the government's basically bailed out all these investment bankers. So that got us through that crisis. But now we see with the sovereign debt crisis, individual national governments are in trouble, and they're going to go down if we don't act, if people don't do something. And so what has been the solution to this? So you just see how things are getting worse and worse. Before, it was a silly little tech bubble that blew up. Then it was replaced with the housing bubble that blew up that would have threatened to take down household investment banks. Whereas if Greenspan had done nothing in the early 2000s, it's not like Lehman Brothers would have gone under or Goldman Sachs would have gone under. So, you know, they weren't that endangered back then. But given what Greenspan did to save the day, then they did get sucked down, the next thing, or they would have if the government hadn't intervened. All right, so now the point is, by bailing out the investment banks, governments themselves, major governments too, it's not just, you know, like Zimbabwe or something in this trouble. I mean, you're talking about like the Greek government, possibly the Italian government, Ireland, okay, Spain. These countries are all in trouble of defaulting on their debt. And so what has been the solution to that is basically the Federal Reserve and the ECB have just been printing money like crazy to bail these governments out. So that has been the backstop. So now my point is, if this doesn't work and all we're really doing is postponing the inevitable, just like Greenspan really didn't do any favors for us by giving us a housing bubble, and Ben Bernanke and the European governments and Hank Paulson and Geithner didn't really do us any favors by bailing out all the investment bankers, just made the crisis fester, so now it's even worse. My point is, there's nothing left. You know, once the government, now they've bailed out the national governments, the central banks have, there's only one step left, and that is the paper money itself. And so we see already it looks, you know, there's a danger of the euro itself collapsing, that people are going to realize this, you know, lose faith in the ECB, let alone the individual governments in the European area. And then they might rush to the dollar. And right now I think that's partly why we in the United States have seen less inflation, price inflation, is because Europe is so bad, a lot of investors see nowhere else to go, and so they're going into dollar-denominated assets. But let's say the euro goes down. I think in order to try to save them, the Federal Reserve is going to kick it into high gear and just keep printing to bail them out. And then there's going to be one last thing is the U.S. dollar. And then what happens when people finally realize even that's not a safe place to be, and that goes down? Okay, so anyway, obviously we can't say for sure that that's the way it's going to happen, but that's kind of the bird's eye view that I have, that they just keep kicking the problem up one more level because they keep thinking they're going to contain it and their policies don't work because they violate the laws of economics. And so that's the sort of pessimistic outlook I have here. So that's the theme that's guiding the kind of stuff I'm showing you, is I want to show you why, if that's the backdrop you have in mind of what's happening, a lot of this data is consistent with that pretty depressing story. Okay, so back here you can see central bank assets. So this first diagram, so what is it? Is a percentage of GDP. So what they're doing here is they're looking at the asset side of central banks' balance sheets, and they're adding that up and getting, you know, the total in whatever that region's currency is, and then they're looking at the annual GDP of that particular region. So for the United States, the red line here, that's obviously looking at the Fed's assets and then dividing by U.S. GDP. So you can see for a long time, you know, 01 up until the crisis, Is that a zero? Yeah, so it was like 5-6%, and then boom, in just the last 3 years, it's gone up, it's more than tripled. Okay, so I like this diagram because I've never seen this particular chart. I've seen, you know, the Fed's balance sheet and things like that, but never seen it adjusted to show the size relative to the economy. So that's a pretty dramatic increase in just a few years that the Fed's ownership relative to the size of the economy has tripled. And you can see for the ECB, it's a similar thing. It started out higher, but it ended up higher too. And with Japan, ironically, it's not as bad as it has been, and that's just because the Japanese government has been doing this for a long time. The other thing, too, it's totally beyond the scope of this course. I may touch on it a little bit next week, but this particular document from the BIS, you can see that some of these charts, there was spillover. You know, I wanted to show you one frame, but there are other stuff. There are some indications that the developing economies, what they call emerging markets, that they are just a few years behind us in the development of this. And so it's possible that, or you know, some people worry that China's on the brink of a collapse, for example, that some of these other countries are just, you know, they're going to face their own crises in a few years. So I'm not nearly as confident in that as I am in the thing I was talking about before, that what they've been doing in the so-called advanced economies is just setting us up for a bigger crash or a bigger crisis down the road. But anyway, if you're interested in that and you want to read more, then just go ahead and click on this link that I gave you in the beginning, and you can see that case made. Okay, it's basically this a lot of similar information, but they're also just showing liabilities in addition to the assets. All right, so that's kind of self-explanatory if you want to look at that. Okay, policy rates and inflation. Here, this is just a good diagram to just show you the coordinated efforts of the various central banks. So the Federal Reserve, the ECB, the Japanese Central Bank, and the Bank of England, and how they've responded to the recession, and then in particular things since the crisis began. And you can, again, headline inflation. So anyway, these are, I don't think I need to comment on these, but it's a nice chart to have. Okay, as far as the actual interventions, you know, major events here, in May of 2010, there were two significant things. So on May 9th, the 27 EU member states created what was called the European Financial Stability Facility, and that it was what's called a special purpose vehicle, or an SPV, and the idea was other organizations would lend this thing money, and then this thing would make loans to troubled countries that came to it hat in hand saying, you know, we need help here. So the initial amount was for €440 billion, and then later they bumped the numbers up because they realized that wasn't enough to contain things. And so it was backed by the European Union, other Eurozone states, and the IMF. So that's where this what's called special purpose vehicle was getting its own, you know, getting, where was it getting the euros to lend to these troubled governments? Then the next day, the European Central Bank, you know, talked about how it was going to make these commitments to buy bonds from the troubled governments. Let me, this is probably obvious to all of you, but let me just make sure people aren't getting left in the cold here. So big picture, what's going on? Because the recession, tax revenues are down, food payments, welfare state type payments are up. So all these governments, both the U.S. and all the European governments, they would have been experiencing budget deficits anyway. But then on top of that, a bunch of them foolishly pledged to bail out the investment banks that had made bad decisions, that, you know, would otherwise would have failed except that their governments bailed them out. And of course, they couched that and said it to their public that they were rescuing the financial sector, just like in the United States, the TARP program and all that stuff was sold to the public as a way to prevent the whole world economy from collapsing. It wasn't billed as, oh yeah, some really rich guys screwed up and so now we're gonna bail them out at the expense of everybody else. That wasn't the way the program was sold to the public. So then now these governments are in trouble, and some of the more vulnerable ones like Ireland, Greece, and Spain and so forth, it now comes into question and people start to worry, can those governments continue to make payments on their bonds because they've bitten off a lot? That the economies are still awful, so tax receipts are low. Not only are they paying food stamps and unemployment benefits, blah, 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 but now they just, you know, giving in some cases, you know, trillions potentially, depending on how things turn out, to these private banks. And so people who lent money who are sitting holding bonds issued by these governments are starting to think, uh-oh, these things, they might default. So they want to get rid of them, or if they want to, the yield on them has to be higher to make it attractive for someone to lend money to them because they're a higher credit risk now. Okay, but then this can set up a vicious cycle or circle of self-fulfilling prophecy, whatever you want to call it, where if you're in debt, you know, so the same is true if you're a household or if you're a government, if you're deeply in debt and you're just making ends meet, you know, you're just paying your creditors every month with the limited income you've got coming in the door, and you're okay, you're thinking, okay, all right, I'm keeping my head above water, this is okay, we just keep this up, we'll gradually get out of this hole we've dug for ourselves. But now, you're rolling over short-term debt, right? So as certain debt comes due, you borrow more money from new people to pay off the old people, and then you make your interest payments to the new people, but then when that debt matures, you go into the markets again, you borrow a whole bunch of new debt to pay off the old people, and then you know, so that's the idea. As long as you can keep rolling it over at comparable interest rates, you're fine, right? You dug a big hole for yourself, but you're okay. But now what happens if people think, you know what, I think you're going to default. It doesn't look to us like you can keep this up. Well, then you're dead, because then when your debt matures and you go to the markets to try to roll it over, people say, no, instead of us lending to you at 5%, which is what you've been used to the last few years, we're going to insist that you pay us 10%, which you can't do that, because to pay 10% on this huge debt that you're rolling over, you don't have enough money. You're already running a massive budget deficit. Okay, so that's what was happening in these countries, is once things started to slip away, they were dead. And so the rationale then for these central banks to come in is they come into the markets and they start buying this debt to push down its yield. Okay, so when the central bank, so the idea is private investors are afraid to lend to the Greek government, but the European Central Bank comes in and creates euros out of thin air and buys bonds issued by the Greek government and puts it on its balance sheet. And so that pushes up the price of those bonds, or if it's the same thing, pushes down the yield. Okay, so that does two things. In a sense, what it does is it makes private lenders more likely now, when the Greek government has options and needs to issue new debt and borrow money from people in the private sector, those private sector creditors are willing to accept a lower interest rate offered by the Greek government because they know the ECB is waiting in the wings to buy up that debt at a certain price or a certain yield. Okay, so just like when Ben Bernanke says, we're going to keep interest rates low for the next 2 years, that makes people much more willing to lend to the U.S. government at very low interest rates, because they know if they decide they change their mind and they want to get rid of it, the Fed is a huge buyer waiting in the wings to sop that up. Okay, so that's what's going on here. So on May 10th, the ECB was continuing with these talks about how it was going to, you know, be prepared to do limited interventions. The thing is, though, they got to be careful about it. All right, they can't let markets think that there's guys with a printing press who are telling Greek politicians, spend whatever you want, we'll make more, because then people would panic and they would think, okay, the euro's dead. All right, so it's a fine line they're trying to draw here, and that's partly why you see these conflicting stories coming out and the markets are getting whipsawed, is people aren't sure, what the heck is the ECB doing? Are they bailing these people out and just giving them a blank check, or are they prepared to do a certain amount but then no more? Okay, so that's partly what's going on here, and that's why you see these swings and nobody knows what to expect. Because on the one hand, in order to assure people and to keep interest rates on Greek debt and Spanish debt and Italian debt and so forth down, so those countries don't default, the ECB has to be prepared to buy up their bonds. But if it seems like it's a blank check and investors think that those governments, perhaps are being overly optimistic about what they think their budget deficits are going to be over the next few years, meaning the ECB is going to have to inflate a lot more to keep them solvent, well then, other things equal, that means the euro itself is going to fall against other currencies. And so people get nervous about that. All right, so that's the issue here. So what the ECB does on May 10th is it announces intentions to continue these programs to suppress the yields on these troubled countries, but it was going to sterilize the purchases. And so the idea, what does this mean just generically? When central bankers talk about sterilization, they mean that they're going to try to cancel out on net the effects on the currency. So if the ECB is going to, I'm just making these numbers up, if they say, all right, we're going to buy €1 billion worth of Greek government debt to try to push down the yield on Greek government debt, but we're going to sterilize the purchase, what they mean is, they're going to reduce their holdings elsewhere in their portfolio by €1 billion, so that they're not actually inflating, they're not creating more base money in euros that then the commercial banking system couldn't further inflate upon. That's the idea. So that it's a tricky thing, and this is partly what's going on with all this stuff. It's not just the sovereign debt crisis, it's the financial crisis that began that really struck in 2008 is there's been a qualitative difference. It used to be that the central bank was just, you know, they weren't supposed to be targeting specific asset classes. They were just supposed to be there to sort of provide a general macroeconomic framework of stability. I mean, that's it's funny to even say that, but that was the ostensible purpose of these things. They were not supposed to be bailing out particular companies, for sure, or even general industries. I mean, that's great, and that's central planning is what that is, all right? So, or industrial policy, whatever you want to call it, but this is the crazy position into which they've painted themselves is now they want to be able to bail out particular governments, but they don't want to give investors the idea that they're wrecking their own the currency in doing so. And so that's why they're talking about, oh, we're sterilizing it. All right, so that's what this is. The other thing that this particular announcement talked about was that they were reopening dollar swap lines with the Fed. So in we don't have time to get into it tonight in the Q&A, you know, in the forum there. If you want me to talk more about this, I'll be happy to do so. But the idea here is they don't want the euro to fall too heavily against the dollar. So if it looks like the European Central Bank is inflating to bail out all of these troubled governments in the eurozone, they don't want to, you know, they don't want the euro to crash against the dollar for various reasons, not least of which that would, you know, the United States would get mad about, you know, its exports getting crushed if the dollar strengthens against the euro. All right, so partly the way they mask that is the Fed and the ECB enter into agreements where they engage in currency swaps and things so that the exchange rate between the dollar and the euro doesn't move too far from where they want it to be. Okay, so it's like the layers of an onion. I mean, you start looking into this stuff, and there's all kinds of things where, well, they do one type of intervention, and if that's all they did, there'd be all these negative consequences that would immediately be visible. So they intervene here, here, here. It's like playing whack-a-mole, just trying to keep all the plates up in the air. If you'll forgive me for mixing metaphors there. So that's what I'm talking about when I say they just keep pushing these things back. I mean, it is just, I mean, just look at this. Just seeing what these central banks have done already and then the further commitments they've made, if this thing blows up, it's not going to be pretty. Okay, let me talk a little bit about this issue of fiscal union, because this has literally come to the fore this week. So what do we have going on? Well, already the ECB has committed itself to buying Italian and Spanish bonds in amounts, you know, they pledged it in euros, of course, but the exchange rate works out to about $1.2 trillion. Okay, so that's, I mean, if you think about what the, what do you call it, quantitative QE1 and all that stuff was, I mean, these are comparable amounts just to, you know, not to save the world economy, but just to keep the Italian and Spanish governments from defaulting is how much the ECB has already committed itself, if need be. So they haven't done this yet, don't miss it, but I'm saying the commitment that they made, if they have to follow through with it, means they're going to be buying $1.2 trillion U.S. dollars worth of Italian and Spanish bonds. And so now what happens is, at this point, the European Central Bank can tell these allegedly sovereign governments what they need to do. And so this is part of the political economy of what's going on here. And if you're a conspiracy theorist, you might think that this is part of the plan. Right? So I'm not endorsing this or denying it. I can neither confirm nor deny these rumors. But what I'm just saying is it's very eerie when you step back and look at what's been happening here is all these countries that, you know, were linked together with a common currency, but there were you know, very, you know, nationalist concerns. And so a lot of these people were very strict about, okay, well, yeah, sure, we'll join and use the euro, but we don't want our government's taxing and spending policies to be influenced by other Europeans. Now, we're Germans, gosh darn it, and and the German people are going to decide that stuff. We don't want the French telling us what our tax rates are, and the same for other proud peoples, okay? But the idea here is, and remember what we're talking about in the pure theory of optimal currency area, this is the very logic of it. It doesn't work. You can't have an area that has a centrally administered fiat currency but disparate autonomous fiscal authorities operating within that region. It just doesn't work precisely because of the kind of situation we're in right now. And so the logic here is there's two opposing forces. One way is people are saying we need to get rid of the euro. We need to go back to having our own individual currencies. But the other current, the other trend, is a lot of these, a lot of these elite policymakers and intellectuals are saying, well, yeah, I mean, we kind of knew this wasn't going to work, and we were hoping it would be okay, but it's not. So looks like we're going to have to get even one step closer to being like the United States. So the so first of all, let me just make this point. So the ECB now is telling these governments what to do, and they have no choice. So if you click on this article, I haven't assigned you this, I think it was just literally today in the news. If you follow that link, you'll see that the Italian government is jacking up its value-added tax, and it's doing all these commitments to show the world that, hey, look, we're getting serious about getting our budget deficit under control. But the article says something like, it's not private bond investors that the Italian government needs to placate, it's the ECB. Okay, because right now, it's if the ECB doesn't buy Italian bonds, the Italian government is dead. And so so that's the strange situation we're in now, where it's, yeah, technically speaking, the ECB doesn't have legal authority over what these governments do. They're still independent sovereign nations, but they're utterly dependent at this point on the ECB coming in and buying their bonds. And so these governments now have to show the ECB, oh, we're responsible. You know, it's a, so it's a very odd situation, that because it can't be the other way. You know, you couldn't say, oh, that's not nice. The ECB should just bail them out and let them do whatever they want, because then they'd have a blank check and they would just run massive deficits. So that won't work. You see the issue. So it's kind of like more conventional domestic matters. Once the government starts intervening in things, it's what Mises talked about, just the logic of intervention just keeps leading it to next. So, for example, let me give you an example from the United States with what's called Obamacare, right? That the health, so-called health reform legislation that was passed. What they did is they gave, they required that insurance companies give all sorts of benefits and coverage to various people, but that would have bankrupted the companies, right? If you just said, oh, even if someone's got a pre-existing condition, you got to go ahead and give them insurance coverage, even if the guy, has been diagnosed with cancer or whatever. So what they do is they say, okay, but what we're going to do is we're going to mandate that everybody buy insurance. So that's the way you insurance companies are going to be all right, that we're going to force everyone to get insurance, and then you can charge higher prices to the people that are higher risk, but you can't just deny coverage to people, or you can't, charge them $1 million a year for basic health coverage, right? But we're going to force everyone to get it. So that way, by putting healthy people in the pool, don't worry, you're going to get enough revenue that you'll be able to stay in business. And I think that's partly why the insurers went along with it, because originally the insurance companies in the United States were adamantly opposed to the Obama administration's intentions, and then all of a sudden they got in the line. And so it seems like what happened is behind the scenes they cut a deal, and they stopped doing all their attack ads and everything, probably because they stupidly thought that the government was going to guarantee that everybody had to get insurance. Okay, so these, I'm venting because these guys are idiots, if that's what happened, they trusted the government, and look what's going to happen to them. So the government basically saying, yeah, there's all these uninsured people walking around because they're healthy or they're young, and they're not, we're going to force them to buy coverage from you, so you're going to have this captive market, But as a concession, you know, we got to sell this politically, so you guys, you know, you have to give policies to sick kids and everything, okay? And the insurance company said, okay. Well, now people were bringing lawsuits, and so there were constitutional challenges saying you, the federal government can't force someone to buy health insurance, and that's you know, in certain courts, those things have gone through. And saying, yeah, you can't do that. So it looks like what's going to happen is, you know, as of right now, unless things change, the parts of the legislation mandating that insurers can't drop people for certain things, you know, or can't deny you coverage if you have a pre-existing, that stuff's all going to still be there. That's all constitutional. But the government can't force healthy people to go buy insurance if they don't want it. So now all the private insurers, that's not going to work. They're going to go bankrupt. And various employers, the way these things are designed, are going to just drop all their employees because it doesn't make sense. It's cheaper for employers to pay the fine for not giving their employees health insurance than it would be to give the employees health insurance, the way these numbers are designed in this legislation. So if you were cynical and conspiratorial, it looks like this plan was designed from the outset to make it look like, oh, gee, we accidentally destroyed the private health insurance market in the United States. Well, I guess we'll have to have national health care. You know, what a coincidence. And I'm saying here, things are playing out as if it's just dumb luck, and it looks like, well, gee, we have no choice but to follow Mario Draghi's, you know, the incoming ECB head's advice that Europe needs to make what he's quoted as saying, a quantum step up in economic and political integration. And the current ECB head says he's calling for a federal European government that could, quote, impose decisions on countries that threaten the euro area. Right? So it just looks like these are, oh, you know, we had no idea this stuff was coming, when plenty of academics and other analysts from the beginning were warning that this is what's going to happen if you impose a, you know, a fiat currency on a region that has disparate fiscal authorities. Okay, hang on, let me just see. Okay, got two slides left. Just going to pace myself here. So another situation that developed literally just yesterday is the Swiss National Bank made a fairly shocking announcement. So let me just bring you guys up to speed on what this is. So they said that they were going to put a hard floor on the exchange rate of the Swiss franc to the euro. Because what's been happening is, in addition to investors flocking to the U.S. dollar and gold and silver, they've also been going to the Swiss franc because that was perceived as a relatively safe asset. And so, and when I say that, let me just make sure you guys get this. It's not that when we say investors are rushing to the dollar or they're rushing to the Swiss franc, we don't mean that people are getting suitcases and filling them up with $100 bills, or they're filling them up with, you know, paper notes issued by the Swiss National Bank. What we mean is they're buying, for example, government debt from the United States government that's denominated in dollars, or debt issued by the Swiss government, or other safe assets in those currencies. And so if you want to buy those things, you have to take your own currency and exchange it for that currency. All right, so before this crisis broke out, let's say you were managing a fund that managed people's pensions or something, or a hedge fund, whatever. You're somebody in charge of managing a lot of other people's money, and you're trying to earn them a return, but obviously you want to be conservative, you don't want to lose it all. And so originally you had a bunch of stocks and bonds issued by European governments that were denominated in euros, the bonds were denominated in euros, and now because of all this crisis, you're like, whoa, I want to reduce my exposure to the eurozone. So the idea is you would start selling off those things, and then you'd want to buy bonds issued by the Swiss government, or buy corporate stock from Swiss companies. So the point is, in order to do that, if you just think through logistically, how would you actually implement that? Well, you would sell the equities and bonds in the European markets, and you'd get euros with them, and then you'd have to go into the foreign exchange market and exchange those euros for Swiss francs, and then use the Swiss francs to buy the Swiss assets. All right, so just basic supply and demand, that means there's now more euros chasing Swiss francs, so that makes the price of a euro go down, wait, no, up, wait, I'm mixing myself up, go down and vice versa, okay? So the Swiss government or Swiss National Bank didn't like that because now the Swiss franc is getting stronger and stronger against the euro. Obviously, Switzerland does a lot of its business with countries that use the euro, and so if the Swiss franc keeps appreciating, that makes it hard for Swiss exporters because now their products are more expensive to all the potential European customers. So the Swiss National Bank finally put its foot down and said, we're not standing for this anymore. It's not fair that we're getting crushed because Europe's falling apart. You know, that's not our fault. Why should we go into recession because of you guys and because speculators and investors are just freaked out and are rushing into our assets? So the thing that was so shocking is they gave this particular number. So it's, they were saying they didn't want the Swiss, so right, the rate they said is that they wanted a Swiss franc, they'd take 1.2 Swiss francs to get 1 euro. And they didn't want it to go any lower than that because as people were rushing out of the euro and trying to buy Swiss francs with it, that was making that number get lower and lower. Or the other way of looking at it is to say euros to Swiss francs was getting higher and higher. And so you can see here, that's what this chart's measuring. So if you look at the news reports, they were reporting the 1.2. If you look at this chart, it's 0.83, but that's because the news reports are talking about Swiss francs to euros, and this chart's talking about euros to Swiss francs. Okay, so you can see how lately it's been going up as this crisis has been intensifying, and then once the Swiss National Bank made the announcement, it crashed. Because now investors realize, oh, okay, they're just going to keep printing Swiss francs to implement this. So partly the reason this was so surprising is that, first of all, they gave a specific number, and then they also said, we are prepared to print unlimited quantities of Swiss francs in order to achieve this objective. All right, so that's, central bankers don't normally talk like that, because that's too definitive. So anyway, that was the deal there. So again, you can just see how this is all, it just keeps sucking in more and more areas. That Switzerland should have been fine. Why would their economic and fiscal policies get screwed up because of the Greek government's debt problems? Well, because the ECB promised to bail them out, and that made investors flee the euro and into the Swiss franc, and then that is going to hurt exports from Switzerland, so that induced the Swiss National Bank to commit to an open-ended inflationary policy, which, if you believe in Austrian business cycle theory, does not bode well for the Swiss economy over the next few years. Okay, last point I'll make is I just want to explain what Krugman's doing here and the pieces I gave to you. So again, Paul Krugman is classic, where he gives bad policy advice and then after the fact tries to spin it and say what a genius he is. So when it comes to TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, where the U.S. government was going to bail out the private investment banks of up to $700 billion, I and other Austrian economists were totally opposed to that from day one. Paul Krugman was for it. Now, he gave his nuances and blah, 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 but he was for it. Then I don't remember if he came out one way or the other about what the Irish government did. But then later, turned out Iceland did not bail out all of its banks. You know, and if you read the Howden piece from week one, in Iceland, the real estate boom and bust, and their private banking system was basically as bad as the Irish. I mean, they were both awful. Like how much massive amounts of debt their private banks had accumulated. But the major difference is the Irish government completely put itself on the hook for its private banks, whereas the Icelandic government did not, and it let them, declare bankruptcy and restructure the debt and so forth. And the other difference is Iceland had its own currency. So Paul Krugman, after the fact, is trying to spin that, and he was saying, yep, the orthodox economists were saying that we need to bail out the bankers, and we need to have a strong, hard currency and not inflate our way out of this. And look what happened. That's what Ireland's been doing. We need to, have austerity. Look at Ireland, whereas Iceland was very unorthodox, and they let the private banks go under, and they let their currency fall, and they are not, engaging in nearly as much fiscal austerity as some of these other countries. And look at Iceland is actually doing better, especially in terms of unemployment, than Ireland is. So therefore, we unorthodox economists were right, and the fuddy-duddies running the show were wrong. So like I say, that's silly because the Austrians, of course, were against, the Austrians didn't tell the Irish government, oh, yeah, you should accept all the debts that your private banks accumulated. So anyway, Krugman, in that follow-up that I also posted for you guys, had to deal with that. And he said, yeah, some people in the comments were wondering, how could I pat myself on the back for telling the Icelandic government not to bail out their bankers, or the Irish government too, when I was for the TARP program? And he said, well, it's because numbers matter. And so his point was the U.S. government wasn't getting in that much of the hook for a $700 billion program, whereas the Irish government, for its size and compared to how much private debt it was guaranteeing, was a much bigger thing. So, I mean, you can read that if you want, but it's certainly not an issue of principle. I mean, I think basically he was caught contradicting himself, and then he just came up with some ad hoc. Well, it was because, in other words, he's admitting the policy is crazy to do if it's 10 times your GDP, but if it's only 10% of your GDP, then it's not. Then all of a sudden, it's a great policy. All right, anyway, Krugman irks me, so that's why I focused on that. Okay, let me turn now to your questions. Also, just so you guys know, I'm going to have to end right at the official time today because I have my son is in the drop-in center, and I have to get him. Also, while I'm pulling it, let me mention, I will try to get it posted and give you a few days' notice, but like I say, every day something new happens relevant to this course, so I may assign some more readings for week four, which is our last week, but we'll send out an email if and when we do that. I already have at least one thing that I'm going to send you, but I'm waiting to see if I can get anything else. Okay, so questions for the professor, week three. Okay, Pear says, obviously Krugman is not led by principles. Pragmatically, the Irish bailout is too much for him, but sticking it to the U.S. taxpayers for the benefit of banks is okay. Comments? Yeah, I mean, you got the point of why I put those articles up there, to show that it's, first of all, not only that he was inconsistent, but also that he had the audacity to make it look like it was he and the other mavericks who are out there talking about not bailing out banks and letting the private banks fail, when that has been the crazy Austrian position throughout this thing. Okay, Gary says, why should the insolvency of any constituent member state challenge the survival of the Eurozone? If, for example, the state of California became insolvent, its insolvency would not cause the insolvency of other U.S. states or the U.S. federal government, and it would not end the role of the U.S. dollar as a common currency. Isn't the danger more that the insolvency of one or more sovereign states could result in large losses for the European banks, and that, in turn, would cause a monetary deflation in the Eurozone as the banks are forced to liquidate assets at a loss? Okay, great question, Gary. Yeah, it's, you guys can tell I haven't read this before because I'm befuddled at such a good question. Okay, so what Gary is pointing out, let me just paraphrase it while I try to think of a good answer. He's questioning the whole premise of this. He's saying, wait a minute, why are we assuming that the euro itself, in terms of the currency, why is that in trouble if the Greek government defaults on its bonds? Who cares? And he's saying, by analogy, that would be like, you know, suppose the state of California defaults on its bonds, which could very well happen, by the way, or the state of Michigan also. Well, maybe them too, but I meant to say Illinois. So what? It's not like people would say, oh my gosh, the project of the U.S. dollar zone is now in danger because the state of California defaulted on its bond payments. You know, nobody would talk like that. And you're right, Gary. It's sort of just been assumed that it would that the euro would collapse. And so when I, just to clarify, when I am saying the euro is in trouble, I'm saying because they're not just going to let them fall. I'm saying it's because the European Central Bank is now coming in and buying up these things, and it's not going to work. They're just going to go down with the ship, or, you know, or not go down with the ship. You know, when people are trying to rescue somebody else that's sinking, and then you get pulled in yourself. So what could happen, and this is what I was waiting for as a sign of, is the dollar in trouble, is when these state governments, it's receded a little bit in the last few months, but about, I don't know, 6 to 8 months ago, there was very serious talk of, is the California government going to default, and the Illinois government, and a few other ones. And there was serious talk of, well, gee, you know, should the Fed come in and start buying California state bonds? So if Bernanke had done that, or if he does it in the future, that to me is really going to be a signal that, yeah, the dollar is done, because they're just bailing everybody out. They just think they can just keep printing money, and that's going to solve all the problems. So so I think you're right. And just so again, just to clarify, when I'm talking about the euro itself being in trouble, I mean because they're not letting these individual governments default. As far as the second part of your question, okay, what? So Gary's saying, suppose these governments of these sovereign states default. Isn't that hurting the European banks? And I think he's right. So that's what a lot of these people are saying, is that what's going on here, it's not like there's a bunch of disinterested academics sitting around trying to do what's best for Europe, and gosh, they just have bad ideas. That all of this stuff has been driven by protecting the big banks. So that's why the governments originally bailed them out, and then now that the governments themselves are in trouble. Well, there's still lots of financial institutions holding government bonds that don't want them to default, so they're looking at the central banks saying, well, you can't let that happen. So I think you're right about that aspect of it too, Gary. Williams says, didn't the Feds start those TIPS things, so Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, is a way to keep money going to treasuries instead of gold? And possibly, I mean, we don't know. I'm not inside the heads of the people who did that. I mean, the official explanation would be no. They were just doing that as a to broaden the markets and to provide more stability. That now, you know, people can back out the market's implied inflation expectations. So just as a service to the public, and to just allow for greater for implementation of more sophisticated financial strategies and to spread risk around, blah, 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 right? It helps if you've got a benchmark real rate of interest is determined in markets because you've got Uncle Sam issuing these things. So that would be the official reason. I would need to go look at when they actually started issuing those things. So you're right. In case people don't know, William is right. These TIPS things, especially in the very long end maturities have, they're relatively recent. Okay, so you, if you want to look at, and I know this because when I worked in the financial sector, certain projects, we'd want to go back and look at the spread between nominal and tips and go back a few years and compare it with other stuff. Because I wanted to see, what, that was one of the things I personally was interested in. I wanted to go back and look historically and see, okay, the so-called break-even inflation rate, how good of a predictor is that to the actual CPI? You know, so go look at 10 years ago and look at what the market was saying 10-year inflation was going to be, price inflation, and then look at actual price inflation over those 10 years and see, you know, that was partly what I was trying to do, but I couldn't really do it very well because the tips were relatively new. You know, you couldn't go back that far to see this so-called break-even inflation rate. So anyway, William is suggesting that maybe part of why they rolled those things out was so that investors who were worried about price inflation would keep lending to the U.S. government as opposed to switching out of bonds, U.S. bonds altogether and getting into stuff like gold. So yeah, that wouldn't surprise me, William, but I don't know anything except the motivations of the incentives that they would face. I don't have any particular insight into that. Okay, William says, wars start a lot because of nationalism. With the ECB dictating to debtor EU nations, couldn't that be fanning the flames of nationalism and possibly war? Yeah, sure. I mean, this is getting bad. You know, not to be too sophisticated about it, right? You got people rioting because of austerity measures, and those austerity measures now, if not merely because of the bankers, like the way in the United States, people are mad. You know, there are a lot of American citizens who are mad that their taxes are higher and that the dollar is going to be weaker because we bailed out a bunch of bankers. But at least the perception is it's mostly U.S. bankers we bailed out. But I can imagine in Europe it's got to be that much worse if, you know, there's kids, you know, kids rioting in Greece thinking that we're bailing out. You know, we're having austerity imposed upon us. Our government's cutting our unemployment benefits and so forth, or cutting the assistance for college tuition because some government or some banker somewhere bought a bunch of, you know, mortgage-backed securities, and then they got into trouble, and they bought some bonds, and they got into trouble, and now they want to get a blank check, and they want to get totally bailed out. So that's why now, and they're in other countries. So it's not just a class difference, but like you bring in the nationalist angle. So yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I'm not saying there's going to be a war, but I'm saying it's they're definitely fanning the flames of social conflict here, and that's partly why a lot of people are saying the whole Euro project may collapse, is because these groups don't want to be united anymore. So again, it's those competing forces. Some people are trying to say, let's just split apart, this isn't working, and other people are saying, no, the only way this is going to work is if we integrate more fully. Okay, just one more quick one. Christopher says, using an Austrian framework, how might one go about describing the potential impact of the European situation as it is now developing on U.S. economic performance from this point forward? Well, if the U.S., well, let's say Ron Paul were president, then I would say, well, there's two different forces. On the one hand, you know, as Europe stagnates, U.S. producers are going to capture more of the market share for other international customers, right? So regions that used to import stuff from Europe would switch some of their business to the United States if Europe is a basket case. But at the same time, the European market wouldn't grow as much or would shrink, and so the United States couldn't sell as much to them. So in terms of standard measures of GDP, it's not clear which force would predominate there. But Ron Paul's not president. So my concern about this is, like I said before, that what's going to happen is if the euro itself starts to to get into trouble, where people realize, oh my gosh, the European Central Bank is not the mother of all backstops, that the euro itself now it starts tanking against other things, what can happen is the Fed can bail them out. And if that happens, then that's going to be really scary. So in other words, if the euro starts sinking against the dollar, and then the way the policymakers try to fix that is the Fed promises it, well, it's going to, you know, those currency swaps or whatever that, you know, whatever nice name they want to use or nomenclature they want to use, but basically they're printing up more dollars and buying euro-denominated assets with it to suppress the dollar's appreciation against the euro. Well, then that's awful. You know, that's just going to set up in motion another boom-bust cycle. So that's that'd be my answer for that. Okay, well, like I say, I got to stop at this point. I got to go pick up my son. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. For next week, I will send out an email blast, but there will at least be one more reading posted, just again, because this stuff is occurring in real time. And I hope tonight's lecture that I've at least shown you guys the way you can go and parse these news stories yourself, you know, these bloggers are talking about. Okay, so I guess we're living in interesting times. All right, thanks for tuning in, everybody, and I'll see you either on office hours or next week.